Welcome to Wagon Wheel, the cricket podcast where we answer your questions on the sport. I'm Jared Kimber, and the best way to ask the questions is either being live on one of our YouTubes, like now, and you could send a super chat in, or just put a question in. If I have any time at the end, I'll take normal questions as well. Or you can get involved via our Patreon, which is patreon.com/goodareaspodcast, like Sanjeet did. He says, is it always true that the quality of the game improves over time? For example, batsmen today have more shot options for any given ball than before. Or as you suggest, today's bowling attack might have been too challenging for Bradman, even though he was more than twice as effective as the batsman of his era. Has there ever been a period in history where the overall quality of the game has declined significantly over time? No, not really. I mean, there are parts of the game that aren't as good now as it would have been before. So I suppose an obvious one is getting out the way of bouncers. Like, I know there are more bouncers now and they're faster, but before there were helmets, players were much better at not being hit by short balls because you didn't have a choice, right? I think that's certainly something that's changed. I'm trying to think of other things. You know, wicket bowling is not as good today as it used to be. Like, you could probably, if you played a club game now and you... Sorry, if you were a club cricketer who was, you know, pretty handy, you'd probably be better at bowling on a wet wicket than some professional bowlers would be just because you're used to doing it and probably better at batting on it, right? Even though you're not a great player. So I think there are skills that don't exist as much anymore. Like, I would struggle. I think someone asked me this question on Patreon the other day about, you know, how I would go in the 1800s. You know, early 1800s, I think they were talking about, or Hambledon, I think specifically, so late 1700s. And I was like, I think I'd struggle because I've never bowled underarm before, right? In fact, I did a Wisden thing years ago where they got me and Sam Collins to dress up. You can find these photos online, by the way. But they got us to dress up as the cover of Wisden or the logo of Wisden. And one of the things they asked me to do was come in and bowl. And as I came into bowl, I fell over because it's so weird to come in and bowl underarm. So those sorts of things go away. And, you know, there would be other skills as well. Like, I don't think modern players will ever be as good at using their feet to spin as older players, because when bowling was slower, using your feet was more important. But if you're looking about the general quality, it improves over time. Doesn't mean that there aren't outlier players. Like, Don Bradman and Geoff Thompson would have been very, very good in the next era that they played in as well. Like, they would still have been, you know, outliers, but that isn't always the case. Will says, where would Scottish cricket be now if it had got test status in 2000 rather than Bangladesh? Say they won the World Cup match. The previous year. Would Bangladesh had soon got test status in this alternative world? What would the impact have been on Ireland? Yeah, it's a really interesting one. I think my knowledge of Scottish cricket at that period was it was very amateur. So I don't think they had the same sort of ambition or professional drive that Irish cricket had. But perhaps they get that. I think Bangladesh would have come in anyway, just because the amount of people playing cricket over there and the passion for it, I just don't see how you would have kept them away. So I think, and also they had already played Test cricket. So there was a slightly different vibe to that, right, than you would have got with Scotland. How would it have affected Ireland? I think it might have just made Ireland kind of get their act together more. You know, I've said this before, like, you know, 80s and 90s, I've had Irish players argue back with me, but if you go back through the records, I think Scotland were the slightly better side for a long period of time. There were a couple of periods where, Scotland were the better side, and then Ireland had a couple of periods where they were really good as well. But there wasn't much between those two sides. So I think that would have been a really interesting one had it gone ahead well. But yeah, I'm not sure I can give you a great answer, because it's a big sliding door moment, and I don't know how it changes Bangladesh and Ireland. But I think from Scotland's point of view, I don't think they would have been massively... I think they would have really struggled if they'd come in at that point, which is what happened to Bangladesh as well. MF Jim says, does retiring at the right time become a consideration for being a great? No, I'm not worried about that at all. Some players retire too early, some players retire too late. That's just part of it. You're trying to work through those sorts of things. And, you know, it's so hard for great players, because when you've been so much better, even when you start to struggle for a little bit, you just think, well, I will come back and do this again. And you can't sometimes. So no, I would never hold that against a player. Adityan says, I don't expect a verdict, but posting this question to hear you talk about it. Who's the better problem solver, Ashwin or Steve Smith? I probably give it to Steve Smith. Oh, wait a minute, because Ashwin went on to be quite effective in limited overs, didn't he? It's a very good question. I kind of think they're both not perfectly set up for T20 cricket, but Ashwin found a way to make himself useful and Smith hasn't. But in every other way, I think Smith is a better problem solver than Ashwin. I think if anything, that the only issue I would have with Ashwin is I sometimes think he's trying to solve problems that don't quite exist yet, if that makes sense. Whereas he would be much better off at just doing the things that he does well. Whereas I think that's where Steve Smith is probably ahead of him. Steve Smith only fixes problems when he has to. I think sometimes Ashwin, I wouldn't say causes them, but goes out of his way. American Wicket says, what is your opinion on the Champions Trophy and how would you choose to alter it? I would kill it. I would squash it like a bug. Look, it's such a stupid tournament. Let's be honest. We're doing a video for this on the main channel, which will come out just before the Champions Trophy. You're talking about a tournament that has changed what it has been multiple times, that has been cancelled a couple of times, that has been forgotten about at times. Like, you know, so many people are like, oh, we love the Champions Trophy and whatever. Well, where are all those people fighting for it when it disappears, right? Like, I think it makes more sense in the future if you were going to have 16 teams at a World Cup or 20 teams at a World Cup or 32 teams at a World Cup. I think Champions Trophy makes a little bit more sense then. When it's basically exactly the same as a World Cup, it makes no sense at all and should not have existed. I also think it will be changed to T20. I think this will be the last ODI Champions Trophy. And if Champions Trophy continues in the future, it will be T20. Again, I think one of the reasons we haven't seen it change at the moment is because there's already so many T20 World Cups. So, you know, there's a big issue with the way that cricket has run. Spoiler alert. There's too many T20 tournaments at the moment. And then if we fit the Olympics into that as well, it makes it even more confusing. We need to get to a point where we play one T20 World Cup every 4 years. And we have 16, 20, 24, 28, 32, how many teams you want in that. And then in the next part of the World Cup, and then in between that, we have one Olympics and we have one Champions Trophy. Three major T20 tournaments for every, for men and women seems fine to me, right? Over that cycle. Different kinds of tournaments, you know, different outcomes and everything. Absolutely no issue with that at all. But trying to force it into everything else. Sean says, is there a particular reason that Scott Edwards wasn't picked up by any BBL team? As a good keeper and a local player, he seems like a good pick. Does he have to get picked up as an overseas player? Sean, would be my question. So I'm not sure if he has to get picked up as an overseas player, I would assume that their thinking is that they could get a better overseas player in than Scott Edwards. He's a very good player, but he's a very peculiar player. Like, he kind of needs to fit the right kind of team, I think. If it's as a local, and I don't know how these things go, if it's as a local player, he should probably be in a squad. I would agree with you there. He's a peculiar player because you kind of want him to bat at number four or number five, I think, in a big bash kind of team. And he's probably not as talented as other players who usually bat at number four or number five. But there's some weak number fives around. And I would say that Scott Edwards, with his versatility and the odd way he plays, could be better, could be well suited to that. It's a good question, though. Josh says, who do you think would give you the most interesting interview about the technical aspects of batting? I mean, Rahul Dravid was pretty good. Rahul Dravid was very good. I found it really hard with the batters to get them to kind of fully open up about it. I mean, I've had lots of really good chats with people like Ed Cowan. I would love to talk to someone like Usman Khawaja. Maybe Mike Hussey. I almost contacted Mike Hussey for my book because I think I do have his number somewhere, but I don't have a relationship with him and I wasn't sure. And by that stage, I had so many other people. I wasn't sure. Like, Jimmy Adams was great to talk about, but I'm not sure if Jimmy Adams talked about the technical stuff. Ian Bishop was probably one of the ones that probably really helped me on the technical side of things. Maybe think about batting slightly differently. But yeah, it's a good question, Josh. is really a potential option for that as well. I kind of feel that that would be the bowlers. I had this idea of talking to Ashwin, McGrath, and I, because I talked to Bishop already, and I was thinking of talking to maybe Sean Pollock as well. But in the end, Ian Bishop was the only bowler I think I talked to for the book. So I kind of went in a different way with that. But yeah, sometimes I felt if I had like unlimited time to write the book, I think what I would have done is I would have, for every player I could have, and this is probably only maybe the main 20 or 25, I would have liked to talk to a bowler who bowled to them and a teammate of theirs and put the two together. That probably cheats your question, Josh, but I think that was a better way of doing it. Ali says, is the betting market efficient as it is now? Betting is illegal in most parts of South Asia, so I'm not sure if the odds are skewed or do I have a completely wrong view of how the market works? So a lot of money from Asia still gets bet in, let's say, so Betfair is the major market, right? Betfair allows you to trade on the game. So you're not betting against the booking. You're betting against the market itself, what other fans are saying. That has the major syndicates involved and the major professional punters involved, right? So we're talking about the people who could bet $1 million a day. They are on the Betfair markets. Some of that money is directly from Asia. And if you follow, I think I'm right in saying this, the three teams that I've noticed the market favors in bad situations is India, Mumbai Indians, and Nepal, right? Now, that is not Western markets dominating that, right? That is fans in those three countries, two countries and one franchise, betting so much money that it's warping the market. So Mumbai, I find Mumbai really hard to trade on because Mumbai is always shorter than they should be. And if you're on the wrong side of it, you get, of a Mumbai comeback or anything like that, you get completely shafted in Mumbai games. Nepal is another one I have trouble with where sometimes I'm betting and I'm looking at the odds just going, but this doesn't make any sense. Like Nepal should be, 2.5 at the moment and they're like 1.8. Usually with Nepal though, if I'm betting on them, it's because I see a pattern coming up. And so it's a bit different than Mumbai where I might be just going, well, this part of the game, this should be happening. So I haven't been stung on that. But India is the other team that they are usually shorter than they should be. So that is Asian money, right? So the Asian money is still trickling through. You've got VPNs, you've got family members overseas, you've got whatever it may be. There are still a lot of people betting on them. And from what I'm aware, it actually works the other way, Ali. So in Asia, when you are betting on trading platforms, so illegal trading platforms within Asia, you are actually betting on Betfair's market price. So from what I and I could be wrong with this, but this is being explained to me by people in the betting industry, that the trading platforms that you might get in India or Pakistan will be based on the Betfair trading platform market price. So it's not actually on the market share itself. Of course, there's still an element of the odds and everything, like if someone puts in $5 million, but it usually matches up, I suppose is the way of putting it. So no, the betting markets seem to be efficient. There are things that betting markets just don't get very right. Softball in T20 games is one that betting markets don't seem to pick up at all. There's an over-indexing on sixes, which I think comes from fans, which I think really warps the market more than it should. One thing that I like to bet on is when a batter is out of form and isn't scoring very quickly, and the next batter in is, I don't know, Heinrich Klaassen. That is another thing that I think the market gets a little bit wrong. But none of this is because of Asian, markets or anything of that kind. Ali says, just rewatched Death of a Gentleman after many years. What opinion of yours has changed since the big three takeover? I mean, every opinion in my life, probably, Ali. Also, are you still pessimistic about the state of Test cricket as then? No, because I think one day cricket's kind of died in the middle more so than Test cricket. I'm still pessimistic about the way Test cricket is run and marketed. What other opinion has changed since the big three takeover? I think... And I probably, in the movie, it's probably not shown as much of me slamming the smaller teams. I think there might be one bit in the movie. I haven't watched it in a long time. My sons have been asking to watch it, but I haven't watched it with them. But yeah, I think there's one bit in the movie where I might talk about the small nations being soft. And I think if I was to remake the movie now, I'd go a lot harder on them. But yeah, I can't think of that many other things within. I mean, there might be individual things within the movie I said that I disagree with now. But I probably haven't watched that movie in 7 or 8 years. No, what are we? 2025. I probably haven't watched it since 17, 18. I think we watched it when it first came on Prime. So I think someone came over and asked to watch it with me. So maybe that was the last time I watched it. You know, I probably watched it 40 or 50 times, not including editing and writing it and, you know, all the other things. I probably watched it 40 or 50 times before then. So, yeah, really, it, you know, I haven't been able to go back and watch it again. But, yeah, I think someone might have asked me to do a Q&A on it 2017, 2018, and then when it came on Prime. So I don't remember everything I said in the movie, Ali, if we're being honest. All right, let's have a quick break here. And then when we come back from that, there will be more of this kind of thing. And by this kind of thing, I mean Wagon Wheel. A few years ago, I realized that trying to find the best stories in cricket was impossible for any fan. I even tried to get funding to make my own cricket Huffington Post. It never quite worked. But luckily, we finally have someone filling this massive void in our game, Best of Cricket. They scour the publications everywhere to find, quite simply, all the best news and the greatest stories on our sport. Then they make it just as easy. They either email it or WhatsApp it direct to you. Cricket's greatest tales delivered to your device. This is truly the best of cricket. All right, welcome back. It was Ellie's question. All right, Richard says, do you remember India's Test series in South Africa in 2010-11? I remember covering it. I think it got overshadowed by the Ashes, but it had a... Oh, maybe I didn't cover it then. Yeah, you might be right. But it had a lot of highlights. Tendulkar versus Steyn, Laxman hitting 96. Is that a common distribution for a lot of Test series, or bowling averages usually closer together? So he's talking about Steyn averaging 17, 24 for Morkel, 24 for Sahir, and 29 were the only everyone else average over 40. I think that's fairly common. You know, it's quite often that you just have two or three great bowlers, and everyone else struggles. So it seems a lot. Yeah. So maybe I did miss that series. I thought I was getting confused with the one before that, perhaps, which I think I did cover. But yeah, I don't remember that one. So I was probably in Australia. I was writing a book and covering the Ashes. Aditya says, in Test, the best spinner of all time is clearly Warner Murali. But is it as clear in ODIs? Warner Murali are clearly top three or four, but someone like Sakhalin come into the conversation. Do you know, Aditya, I've never looked at it. So I don't think, obviously, Warne doesn't play that much. When he did play, he had a huge impact in winning a World Cup. Murali won a World Cup as well. Sakhalin's a really, really interesting one there. But I would have to go through it a lot more. But you know, off the top of my head, I think you make a good point, but I'd have to have a look at how much Sakhalin actually did. Ben says, the All Blacks have a no dickheads rule because they can afford it with their talent. If you were building a Test team, would you care about team cohesion, or would you pick the best 11 and it's up to the management to manage the players' behaviours and personalities? Yeah, I hate the no dickhead rule so much because everyone uses it, right? And no one else is the All Blacks. Yeah, if I had the 25 best rugby players in the world, I could afford to not pick three or four of them. I think, so one thing I did when I was sort of general manager, you know, of a team was I tried to work out what the motivation for each human was, what each player was. And then is there a way of getting them the affection and the love and the interest and the money and whatever it may be that they want, right? Respect, all these different things. There are going to be some players where you're just like, it is too hard to be able to handle this particular player. But generally, I don't think that's the case. I think good management and good leadership can overcome all these other issues. And I think generally what happens is you have a player who's difficult to deal with and you get bad management and bad leadership. And that is why these things happen. Now, whether I'm the person who can give great leadership or not, I don't know, but I'm more likely to take a bet on talent than personality. Because, well, who's to say this other person is a dickhead other than me? And I might be a dickhead. That's the problem with the no dickhead rule, right? We're assuming I'm not a dickhead and I'm saying someone else, you know, Langer would talk about the no dickhead rule. I know people in cricket who think Langer's a dickhead, right? Like, I'm not having a go at Langer. He might not be a dickhead, but I'm saying there are people in cricket going, I hated dealing with Justin Langer, but, and they would go through their reasons and all these things. Darren Lehman would talk about it sometimes too. There are plenty of people in cricket that don't like Darren Lehman, right? Like, you're making a dictator be an arbiter of a silly rule. So I could never use that rule, but it doesn't mean that there aren't players who I think couldn't work with a core that I had. Ubik says, where does Aaron Finch rank all time as an opening batter in T20 eyes? I don't ever look at T20 eyes, Ubik. So he probably ranks pretty high in them. I remember him being really good in T20 international cricket, but I don't look at that. I think he's probably just below the greatest. You know, he's probably more on the a really, really good player than an all-time T20 great would be my thinking on him. Will says, isn't the obvious compromise on tiered tests a Eurovision-style system? Finally, someone had the courage, Will, to say this. Where there is promotion and relegation, but the biggest teams can't be relegated. England, India, and Australia can never leave Division 1. Similar deals with smaller, poorer sides about never being relegated for Division 2 or Division 3. Far from ideal. Yeah, I don't see the point in that. I wouldn't be involved in that. I didn't realize that was part of Eurovision. That you've broken all my strong feelings about Eurovision now. Eurovision and two-tiered test cricket together at last. Jane says, since the last IPL, Jake Fraser-McGurk has scored 280 runs across 22 innings at a strike rate of 117. It's remarkable, isn't it, Jane? Also excluding last year's BBL, he had scored 270 runs at a strike rate of 103 across the past three editions of the tournament. Is he really that promising a prospect, or just someone who had a brief explosion across a period of time that got overhyped by the media? Kind of akin to Lynn's sanity, I guess. I wonder if Jake Fraser-McGurk doesn't have the highest ceiling and the lowest floor of any player in the world at the moment. Because I was really interested to see what happened in the IPL, because I could see teams talking themselves into him at 15, 20 crore. And I could see a bunch of other teams going, is he worth 3 crore? Like, what's the gamble price for Jake Fraser-McGurk, right? What's the gamble worth taking? I think the way he hit the ball in that series and the way he hit the ball just briefly before that, it's not a fluke, like, as in he has a ball striking capability that very few cricketers I've ever seen possess. He might be the best actual striker of a cricket ball I think I've seen, right? Is it repeatable? At the moment, doesn't look like it. Is it possible that he was in very good form and it all clicked and it might take him another 2 or 3 years to ever get back to that? Very, very possible. Is it possible that that's all he never does it again? I'd say no. My worry is that it took a while for Chris Lynn to be worked out, but once he was, he really wasn't that good a prospect anymore, right? Like, Chris Lynn went from being one of the most exciting players in the world to being an okay BBL player and a fringe franchise player. There's some stuff in Jake Fraser-McGurk's batting that reminds me of that, but I still think there's another way about it. I just think he needs to stay in his shape, wait for the balls to be in his areas and play through the line with the way that he's been going, and he'll be fine. I do notice there's been a lot of people in his ears, and I've heard this a lot. It might be a case he just needs to just say to everyone, look, I get it. Please just let me play the way I do. If you don't want to pick me, don't pick me, but let me play the way I do. MF Jim says, is there a big correlation between how fast the bowler can bowl and height? I know Webster and Holder don't hit the 140s of other similar heights. Someone like Mark Wood is a bumblebee, and it makes no sense how he hits 150. No, I think, you know, there's different forms of athleticism that get you bowling fast, right? And, you know, someone like Mitchell Starc might be able to sling his arms further than someone else. But there isn't one kind of athleticism, whether it be height, whether it be strength, whether it be fast twitch muscle fibers, that actually help you bowl fast. You know, it's a combination of a few different things. So, being tall doesn't mean you can bowl fast. Being short doesn't mean you can bowl fast. The Tooth says, how do you view Virat Kohli as a problem-solving batter? Is your opinion different with conditions as opposed to match situations? Conditions compared to match situations. I think he's better than like a normal player, but I think he's more in that Ricky Ponting mode of, he is going to make slight tweaks to what he does, but what he does should overcome everything else and did for at an alarming rate for a good few years. So I think within that, it would be hard to say that he probably didn't have to learn elite problem solving skills the way that other players did. But he does have some problem solving skills, as in when people started bowling wide Yorkers to him, he went off and he spent, you know, a couple of months in the nets working on ways of handling wide Yorkers and then came back with a weapon. What he can't do is probably what those incredible players at the, you know, the best 15 or 20 batters of all time maybe can do, which is within an innings change. Oh, actually, that's not even fair because some of those guys can't even do it. What he can't do is what some players just have the ability to do, which is within an innings completely change what they do for, because the bowling is different, because the pitch is different, because the match situation requires it. I don't think Virat Kohli has those level skills at the top level, but everyone is different. Rahul Dravid is a top 15 test batter of all time. And I think if you were in a test match to say to Rahul Dravid, you need to do this now. Well, I know this because he's told me this. He's like, I can't change in the game. This is how I bat, and this is how I'm going to bat. And so that doesn't mean that Rahul Dravid is not great. And there's another player I was thinking of as well. Len Hutton. I think Len Hutton is probably another one of, when I talk to people about Len Hutton, they just said he just didn't make mistakes. No one ever said, oh, but when the bowlers did this or when the bowlers did that. No, it was just like, no, he made a decision based on each ball being the one that would alleviate mistakes so that you could not get him out. He wasn't a problem solver. His method was almost perfect for most situations. Now, Len Hutton is maybe a top five or a top 10 batter of all time, right? So there are plenty of players that don't have that. Preston says, if cricket were organized into a tier system, would teams still be allowed to schedule bilateral series outside their designated tiers? Well, being that no one has come up with this at the moment, Preston, we have no idea, but I would say yes. If England were placed in their tier two and Australia in tier one, yeah, there's nothing to stop anyone from ever playing friendly games, right? That's what a bilateral is. That wouldn't be an issue at all. And it shouldn't even be factored in, I don't think. You can't stop teams playing games against each other. It will happen all the time. Nicola says, Australia would be desperate for young, top-order, first-class batsmen to put their hands up, like Wiley, Callaway, and Goodwin. Of these, only Goodwin is making obvious improvements on his return season on season. All look like they have solid defences, but Wiley and Callaway in particular seem to struggle to turn the strike over. Yeah, I've noticed that with a lot of young Australian batters now. Like McSweeney is one. Who's the guy, the young guy from Victoria? Ash something? Is it Ash? Who just doesn't score at all. Oh, there you go. You got him there. Achandra Singer. So it does seem a really weird one. You've basically got attacking T20 players and you've got guys who can't score singles in Australian cricket. Do you have any opinions on these? Goodwin's the only one I've seen a lot of, probably because he's made more runs. I need to see a little bit more, but you could see how there is a potential top-level batting talent within Goodwin. I think that's fair to say. I mean, God, his old man was a good player as well, which has nothing to do with his talent. I'm just pointing out, Murray Goodwin was an incredible player who never got the most out of himself for many different reasons. Let's have a quick break here, and then after the break, more questions on the wagon wheel. And that is why Australia decided to drop Shane Keith Warne. Cricket is a game of strategy, of picking the right players for the right moment, or playing the right shots at the right ball. And Hit Wicket captures that perfectly. In Hit Wicket, you're not just picking a team, you're collecting cricket legends, expanding your squad with each new addition. The more players you have, the more options you have to dominate in any situation. And then comes the real challenge, picking your playing 11. Who are your opener, run machine, and Mr. 360? Do you stack your top order with aggressive batters, or do you build a solid foundation? And what about your bowling attack? Do you go with pace, spin, a mixture of both? We've got the Tasmanian Devil, Jimmy, and Boom. The possibilities are endless. The beauty of Hit Wicket is that you need to adapt your lineup to your opponent. They can be powerful, balanced, and technical. Each class has an edge over another. It's a tactical dance where you need to anticipate your opponent's moves and exploit their weaknesses. So if you think you've got the strategic mind to build a championship team, download Hit Wicket and prove it.
Fourth Rock says, love your show. Could you tell me the current match factor, the Fab Four,
And where I can find the Match Factor data. Also, if you have Match Factor stats, we're available. Also, if all Match Factor stats were available, who do you think would have been more superior, Lara, Viv, or Sobers? We do have those. Matchfactor.streamlit.app is where Varun's putting all that. But we do have it for all players. We have it for WG Grace. Match Factor is actually quite an easy one. You don't need ball-by-ball data or anything else. You just need the what the top six in the rest of that game went at. I've got a feeling that Lara has the highest Match Factor. Now, there's a couple of reasons for this. This is one of the weaknesses of Match Factor, you know, and that we brought up quite a bit. So Match Factor compares your batting average to the other top six batters in your games. Sobers had Conrad Hunt, Rowan Kanai, Everton Weeks, Clyde Walcott, Frank Worrell. Am I missing anyone? Those are the main ones. There's some good batters there. Also flat pitches. That's why they all have great records, but some very good batters there. Viv had Greenidge, Haynes. I'm missing someone else really good in there. Greenidge, Haynes, Lloyd, and there's someone else as well who was good in his period, right? Calatron? Was Calatron in his? So Viv has the highest Match Factor. That is interesting, actually. Lara is the one with probably the lowest from his own team. So that can do it. So I don't think Dravid, Tendulkar, and those guys have a great Match Factor from memory. Right. Okay. That is interesting. So Lara is, I thought Lara would have been at the top, but I couldn't remember. I remember going through it for the book. But yeah, so there you go. Era factor, I think, is quite interesting as well for those guys. Tony Kozier died in 2016, almost 9 years ago. He was the representative of West Indies cricket in the media. After all these years, is his lack of presence still felt? I wish he was still able to commentate on the second division and test situation. Look, it's a big issue with him not being there. There isn't really a voice. Like, Bishop is, obviously, as a commentator, has taken over, but, you know, Bish isn't writing columns or isn't weighing in on the political side as much, because as a commentator, you can't always do that because of who you're working for. Not that he's not forthright when he has to. And Michael Holding was still, you know, I mean, you had Michael Holding and Tony Kozier, right? That's gone. We need stronger voices from the Caribbean. You know, obviously you have the Caribbean Cricket Podcast coming through. You have Nikhil, but these are not like authoritative voices. These are younger, newer voices coming through, which is very, very different. So yeah, there's not having someone like Kozier is an issue, and it's not really going away. Satchmo says, watching Australian TV archives of the 74-75 Ashes, it struck me how primitive the camera setups were compared to the BBC of the time. Was this noted at the time or only exposed by Packer's superior setup? Yeah, BBC wasn't great either, I think, if you go back. But you're right, it was very, very basic. The ABC just doesn't have the money of the BBC, I would assume. I don't know how much it was talked about in general. You would have to go back old Satchmo and have a look at old newspaper articles to see. But it was certainly when Kerry Packer, you know, and Kerry Packer had a lot more cameras than the BBC, it was noticeable how different it is. And you can, if you go and have a look at the World Series cricket footage and look at test footage from even 5 and 10 years later in other countries, Packer was so far ahead of everyone else. Bloody says, which wicket-taking balls are your personal favourites in history? E.g. a Gatting ball, the Strauss ball in 2005. I do love the Strauss ball. I love the Ryan Harris ball to Alistair Cook. Those ones instantly come to mind. There's a Shoaib Akhtar Yorker to Adam Gilchrist in his first test, which certainly comes up. There is a Kemar Roach ball to, I want to say, Mark Stoneman. I might be wrong on the batter, which is just incredible. The arc and the angle that it comes from is when he was still bowling over the wicket to left-handers. I don't know how you hit that ball. Those are a few that instantly come to mind for me. Grove says, I think you misunderstood my shortcut SM amid social media. Grove, if you shortcut, people are going to misunderstand it. I mean, is social media and free opinionated masses and reactions, is social media and free opinionated masses and reactions curtail the role of politics? Okay, I still don't quite understand that sentence. Example, I doubt if 200 active people knew about the political angle Nagpur pitch fiasco that day, but such a sabotage would be called out by 20K users or so today. Does such pressure curtail the worst impulses of politicians? I don't know if you've followed politics recently, Gaurav, based on living in the UK, being an Australian, following American media, following Indian media, I would say no, that has not curtailed it. Politics is as bad as any time I've ever lived in, and the masses don't seem to change anything there. James says, why is there such an imbalance where women's tests have had so many overs are bowled by part-timers, often 6, 7, 8 bowlers more than the odd over, whereas part-timers are last resort in men's cricket. So the reason for this is the same thing you'll see in associate cricket, James. You'll quite often see teams in associate cricket with 7 or 8 bowlers, and it's very rare to see that much in franchise cricket or international cricket at the top level. And that is because the lower the level you go, the more all-rounders there are. I was asked years ago by Richard Doane, who kind of took over from Bob Woolmer and is one of the reasons that associate cricket is so strong. And you know, he knew I'd been an analyst in other formats and you know, mostly followed top-level cricket. And he said, what do you think of my boys? You know, what do you think of associate cricket? And I said, you will know you've done your job when you don't see as many of these bowlers who could not ever bowl an over for a major team delivering serious amounts of overs. And it's the same with women's cricket. I think in 10 or 15 years' time, we know that the professionalism will have come full swing when you have a lot more players who are specialists and a lot fewer players who are all-rounders. That is what eventually happens. We know that from the history of men's major test cricket. You know, you go back and you look at those South African teams around the 1900s and the England teams as well. There were multiple all-rounders all the time playing in those teams. And as test cricket and international cricket has got older and stronger, you see more specialists come in. And when the talent pool widens, you know, it's very hard to be an all-rounder. When the talent pool is quite thin, all-rounders usually are easier to find. Ubik says, do you think another T20 competition will implement the power surge? What do you think of it overall? I forget it exists all the time. And then it suddenly comes up and I'm like, oh, okay. No, I don't think anyone else should do it. I think Trent Woodhill had something to do with it coming in, if I'm not mistaken. I told him at the time it was a bad option. I've given them better options. I've given them and other boards better options. If that's what you want to do, if you want to make it so that there is a consistent scoring pattern in a game that is not set up to have a consistent scoring pattern, as in, if you want it to be exciting all the way through, a power surge is a terrible idea. It's a tactical, cool thing, but it's a terrible idea to actually overcome the issue. The best way to do it is to have 2 fielders out for the first 5 overs, have 3 fielders out for the next 5 overs, have 4 fielders out for the next 5 overs, and 5 fielders out for the next 5 overs. That means there's always a reason to take risks. There's always a reason to try and maximize and score at a fast rate all the way through. Otherwise, what you're going to get is slow start and then you're going to have a bit of a rise. Then you have a dip after the power play and then have a bit of a rise up. All you're trying to do with the power surge is like amp that up a little bit, right? Whereas I just think there's a much better system. Sashbro says, is Colin Croft sometimes underrated compared to the other 3 in that quartet? He was very aggressive and discomforting to face, even by the standards of that side. Didn't seem to mind to hurt any batters. Look, you know, Colin Croft, when, you know, ruined his own legacy, really, by going off to play in South Africa. And compared to the others, I don't think he has the wickets as everyone else. But I think in that era, he was thought of as, what you know, perhaps the worst guy to face. And I think everyone would say that that was the case with Colin Croft, that, you know, that he was just absolutely nasty to face. So I don't think he was underrated then, but other bowlers went on to be greats and he didn't go on to be a great. Average 20 at home, 27 away. Interesting. Because there's not much. I wouldn't have thought the West Indian wickets would have suited Colin Croft any more than the away wickets did. But yes, he was an incredible bowler, but he didn't go on to have the legacy of the other guys because of the Rebel Cricket League. Playing cricket in apartheid South Africa does not help you unless you are an English player. And then you can go on and captain yourself. MF Jim says, now that front foot no balls are all reviewed by the third umpire, should the same be done for waist-high full tosses and head height bounces. Yes and yes. We can measure players, and I think they're already doing that in the IPL. So yes, I would do that. Sean says, what would the reaction and ramifications be if appealing became unnecessary in cricket? Umpires just make a decision based on each ball by default. I've heard of leagues trying this before, like basically just taking it away from the teams. And it went poorly in a way that we have seen decisions go against batters when the bowling team didn't think it was out either. There's something that one reason I like umpire's call, soft signal, and appealing is because everyone has a slightly different view, and the umpires are getting information not just based on if a wicketkeeper doesn't appeal, right? An umpire gets a little bit more information to work with. If square leg and point appeal for an LBW really viciously, the umpires probably know that the height was pretty good. So I would say what you would do if you took away appealing is you would actually give the umpires slightly less subconscious information to deal with. So I think you get more mistakes. Ben says, if Hawkeye was used to track the ball to the slip cordon and keeper, could there be an argument to use slip cordon average as a point of differentiation when choosing between players of similar abilities? Yes, so we can do this already, Ben. I don't know if we can do it with Hawkeye, but yes, we will be able to do this, and not just for slip cordon, for everything. Once we start mapping the field correctly, doing what they do in baseball, spatial tracking cameras, you'll be able to do this. You'll be able to say, well, the ball is traveling at this pace. The fielder was in this position when the bowler started to deliver. And a ball, usually that ball would go for on average 1.1 runs. And when this fielder fields it, it goes at 0.89 runs. So it means they're getting to that ball quicker and people aren't always feeling comfortable with the run. That one's probably a bad example, but you know, you could do that. Let's say you hit the ball wide of long on, which is the one I've always used, and you hit it to the right hand of a right-handed fielder. We know that that fielder, that is worth maybe 1.7 runs. So Kyron Pollard and David Warner Ben Stokes might mean that there's a two there, but the two there is only very rare. And to other fielders, the two there is quite common. We can do that all the way through for wicketkeeping, for fielders, for catchers, everyone. It's just not being used. The technology is a little bit expensive and cricket isn't run correctly. Josh has been watching Freaky Cricket on this channel. Greatest performances across all formats. There was no love for Hadley's 9 for 52, 52 and 61 in the Brisbane 85 test. Surely that must rank among the list. Josh, so when you put a comment in like this, you need to think about what this is. I've got a 10-year-old asking me questions. I don't know what he's going to come up with, which is part of the fun of the show. There are probably great performances. That you've come up with one off the top of your head. You probably missed 8 or 9 other great performances, right? There's probably a couple of Botham ones that we missed out on as well, right? Those sorts of things. Even in Crick Picks, do you know how hard it is to come up with all those? Yes, that looks like a very good test match. Richard Hadley was a very good cricketer. I've mentioned this before. MF Jim says, who are some of your favorite cricketers cricketer? Doug Bollinger was a big one. So what's a cricketers cricketer? I'm not really sure what you mean by that, MF Jim. Yeah, I don't know how to answer that, because especially with Doug Bollinger, you've completely flattened it for me. I like so many cricketers. I don't even know. You'd have to be a little bit clearer on that one, I reckon. Richard says, let's say you're working for a franchise T20 team for a tournament. That's T20, but with a 2 overs limit for bowlers. How would you select a team for that? You need 10 different bowlers. So would you load up on specialist bowlers, or would you throw caution to the wind and just load up on batters and tell them to outscore whatever their part-time bowlers concede? I suppose you're looking at, you probably, so the way that I did it when I worked with T20 teams is, and we've never actually done a video on this, and we probably will for the IPL. We have batters, we have bowlers, we have all-rounders. Those are the three definitions. But I think in my system, there's something like between 28 and 50 different kinds of cricketers. And so for when we're looking at players, we would be looking at specialist batters with a little bit of bowling. We would be looking at specialist batters who are part-time bowlers. We'd be looking at specialist batters who are fifth bowlers, which is probably like Andre Russell, right? And then you do the opposite. So you're looking at specialist bowlers, specialist bowlers who could bat at seven. Specialist bowlers who can bat, who can hit boundaries for you, right? And then there are other versions of that. Maybe, you know, you might have a specialist bowler who can just hit off spin or something like that, right? Something like that. Anyway, that's what you would do. So we try and make sure, and then you have bits and pieces players as well. So you basically, you probably want three of one, you know, you want three specialist batters who can do a bit of bowling, three specialist bowlers who can do a little bit of batting, and then a bunch of as much of the middle stuff as you can find as possible. Jane says, why did university cricket decline in England? We went from giving Oxbridge teams first-class status, which admittedly was a bit much, to barely having any cricketers from university programs. I'd have thought that parents would be clamoring for their kids to get a university education as a hedge. So it was paid for by MCC and ECB, I want to say. Am I right in saying that? But it was paid for by someone specific. So it needs to be paid for. I know that Foxy Fowler was really upset when it was brought about. I think he was the coach at Durham. He was quite outspoken about it. I thought it was a great idea because it's a bit like the American system, right? Like, as in, it means that if you fail as a professional cricketer at the age of 23 or 24, just because you were good at 18 does not mean you're going to be great at 26, 27, right? There are plenty of players have done that. Then they had an education, something to fall back on. But it had to be funded externally, and I think that was the issue. I think what was happening is that ECB was probably working out that they were better at pathways than ever before, at understanding which players from a young age. They're pretty excited with the whole pathway system, I think, internally, if you talk to them about it. They'll be like, if you look at the players that we've picked, but, you know, and they're getting better at that. So they probably believe that then it is an unnecessary luxury to have that. The other side of it is that if you're getting kids with university educations in, you're actually broadening the kind of pool that you're picking players from. As in, not everyone is just a straight cricket brain. Some of these people will have studied other subjects. And, you know, that for me is a really, really important thing because I think it stops your tactical pool, and I don't mean tactics here, but I mean your intellectual pool from just being all one people, all the same sorts of people, the same sorts of backgrounds, right? Professional cricketers from the age of 16, coming through the system, being really good at cricket. You really want outsiders to come in. And so I think that is one reason I like the university system, but I also like it just from, as I said before, the very basics of if you're good at 18, you may not be good at 25. You now have a university education. But yeah, I think it was more to do with the amount of money and who was funding it. I can't remember if the MCC was funding, but I think the ECB was. I think they probably just put their money elsewhere. I think it's a great system for everywhere. I don't think cricket ever needs to be a big high school sport or anything, but I would love it if it's a way of developing cricketers separate to the way that you're currently doing it and also giving kids a backup. I just think it's a great thing. But yeah, it's probably gone, Jane, if we're being honest. It's definitely gone, but we'll probably never see it again, I suppose, is what I meant from that. Let's have a quick break here. And then after the break, we'll come back and I'll take anything from inside the room here on The Wagon Wheel. The scores were level. They just needed a conversation. Instead, the only time they met up was at the same end, and Australia would go on to win that World Cup. In HitWicket, you've got those game-changing special abilities at your fingertips. Need to accelerate the scoring? Bang! Activate 2X, and suddenly every boundary is worth double. That's right, a 6 becomes a 12. The opposition won't know what hit them. Or maybe you need to put the brakes on a high-scoring power play. No problem. Unleash the heck, and watch the batter struggle to even score a single run. In fact, they might even end up going backwards. It's absolute chaos. Look at the King of Spin, for example. But there's more to it than just flashy special moves. Every player has their own unique passive traits that add another layer of strategy. Gilly, for example, he's a seam hunter, a nightmare for any pace bowler. And Beefy, well, he's got a golden arm. The longer a partnership lasts, the more dangerous he becomes. Hitwicket challenges you to think like a true captain. You've got to analyze your players, understand their strengths and weaknesses, and then use those abilities and traits to outwit your opponent. It is a real test of your cricketing brain. Now, if you excuse me, I've got a strategy to revise. All right, let's get some questions up. Ecant says, how did Seven's BBL coverage become so good? I don't know. I don't watch that much BBL. I've watched a few games this year. I haven't noticed anything that's told me that it's exceptional coverage, but it certainly hasn't stood out as being bad either. They offered me a gig before COVID. Was it before COVID? Yeah, I think it was. I'd done some work with Flem and he was like, would you be interested in coming over? I don't know how official that was, but he was like, you know, we really like you. And I think at that stage, Flem was really worried that they didn't have as many cricket people around. And so he wanted me there as another cricket voice. So that something as simple as like they were having trouble with highlights for a while where they would, you know, he would say, I need to show four Yorkers from this bowler. And like when they would put the package together and it wasn't four Yorkers. Yeah, they needed someone like that. And I've had some of my friends have done that job. I think George Binoy did that for Star for a few years as well. So it's certainly, you know, I think at that point they were struggling is the best way of putting it. But yes, I don't know why it's good or if it is good. So I can't really do that one. Ikan says, any cricketer still makes you starstruck? Look, I've never met, I kind of briefly met Sachin. The last player that I had trouble with, there's probably a couple, but it was Martin Crowe and Dean Jones. And that is because I grew up idolizing them. And so meeting them was really weird. And I had a bit of a relationship with Dino. We disagreed on a few things, but we had it. He knew who I was. We'd done some work together. And he would often send me direct messages when he disagreed with something I said. He once got really angry because I said that the way Islamabad had dressed him, he looked exactly like Donald Trump. He had the red tie on. And he's so upset about that. But I always found it weird chatting to Dino because of that, that relationship I had as a kid, and Martin Crowe even more so. And so Martin Crowe, like, I found it really hard. Like, I know that Martin Crowe wanted to, you know, be probably even closer friends than we were. And I found it really hard to be friends with him because of who Martin Crowe was when I was 12 years old, right? Like, I always found that tough. I don't think anyone else, like, I don't know if I've met Kurt Lee, but I've commentated with him. But I don't know if we were in the same place when we commentated. Kurt Lee's another one and Wasim Akram. I suppose those players would be very weird. I don't know if I'd be starstruck by anyone. You just hang around famous people a lot in this job. And yeah, so I would say that the starstruck stuff has probably disappeared. I could be wrong. Maybe someone will come along and change it. But yeah, I wouldn't thought that would ever happen. Ikan says, what is your biggest strength? What is your biggest weakness? I would say my biggest strength is my raw sex appeal. My biggest weakness is body odor. I don't know what you mean by this. I don't know if you mean as a human being or as a writer. Strength, it's probably the thing that has held me back, that when I'm reading a project that I've done, I cannot see the errors in it, that I cannot fix everything, and that things do get muddled up in my head. I'm like, if you listen to this show, how many times will I say, I know the story, but I can't remember the name of the person. And I think things do get jumbled up in my head. And so that is kind of a strength. It has also been a strength, but it's probably my biggest weakness. Like, you know, who was it? Mohammad Rizwan and the other spinner who I kept getting confused, or Cameron Green and Chris Lynn and Chris Green. Oh my God, I almost did it again there. Right. You know, there's obviously wiring in my head that doesn't always work completely accurately as it should. And it probably holds me back a little bit, but it's also a strength. And maybe being really good at narrative is sometimes a weakness as well, right? Because sometimes I can see the narrative and so I can write it, but maybe I get too caught up in that and forget that, you know, to put it all in place the way that I should. So I don't know. Oops. Ben says, I want Denmark to play Argentina in the World Cup. we all want this. I don't know what the state of Denmark cricket is of recent times. I know Argentina, I've heard there's been some good movements about their women's team. But I love going back and reading about the really strong Denmark team. And you know, there isn't as much written about the Argentina team as well. But I love that stuff. Certainly more of that would be great. Arco says, I betted too. It's illegal. But there are apps like 1xBet that you can download and use without a VPN. It's illegal, but not really enforced. Social stigma is there too, but most don't even care. So that was getting back to before about betting from Asia. Look, so this is what I know. If there is $10 million bet on the Betfair exchange, there is usually another $100 million bet in Asia. So it's not as if the money is not being bet. There is definitely a lot of money being bet. Rakshit says, what is the role of square leg umpire in modern cricket? I don't remember them ever making a decision in recent times. Essentially, there's two reasons to have an umpire out there. One is, if you've just got one umpire out there, it's really intense to do every single ball. Like, if you've ever umpired in a club game and the other person doesn't like doing it and you go from end to end, I find it way tougher than having six balls off to relax. You've also got little bits of information that a square leg umpire can have. It's a different view, right? So catches behind the wicket, quite often square leg umpire has a much better view than the umpire behind. Whether the wicket keeper's hands have gone in front of the stumps is another one. There are various boundary lines that they are closer to and everything else. So I think there are plenty of reasons to keep the square leg umpire out there. I don't see any reason in them not being. That's Ruckshit, who's our producer, by the way. So feel free to roast him in the comments, everyone. Why hasn't Australia tried Hunt? Any flaws in his game? I suppose it's still, what are we talking about at the moment? We're talking about a player who is in his career, so I'm just bringing up his numbers, who's averaged 34 in first class cricket, a little bit better in List A cricket. So he's hitting his peak over the last couple of years. You know, 34 is still quite low, right? Like, I think there is definitely an element of, I think there's definitely an element of you being skeptical of a player who's averaged 34. If I go through, I'm just trying to bring up his full numbers here. Where are we? So, last year, in seven games, he averaged 25, and this year he's averaging 45. The season before that, he averaged 24. So, I think looking at this, Hunt made a lot of runs when he first came in, and is suddenly maybe he's finding his peak age now, so he might make a lot of runs now. But if you look at the entire system of his runs, it hasn't been consistent. So there's probably been no period where he's even been averaging 42 or 3 years in a row to get himself into a position to get chosen. Aditya says, batters doing well at numbers 1, 2, and 3 in T20s. Are they always necessarily a good fit to bat at numbers 5, 6, 7 in ODIs? Yes, this is a Sanju Samson question. Batters doing well. Everyone's numbers look better at 1, 2, 3 in T20, right? And so generally the best players are pushed up there unless they have specific skills that don't fit in that area. One day cricket, you probably have a more of an even keel at 4 and 5 type positions. And you might also then have your players at 6 and 7 are maybe more likely to be more specialist batters than they are in T20 cricket at times. You know, in T20 cricket, you might have a Tim David or a Ben Cutting or a Darren Sammy at 6 and 7, right? Whereas in one day cricket, you're probably not going to have those kinds of players. So I'm not really sure how to answer your question because I don't quite understand the way that you've put it together. But essentially, you're going to have better batting options at 5, 6, 7 in ODIs than you are in T20 in general because of you need more batting because the innings goes longer. And so in T20 cricket, the better batting is always going to be at the top of the order. I hope that makes sense. Oh. The question is inspired by South Africa's current ODI style. What overs 1, 2, 5 feel like an ODI 94, while overs 25 to 50 feel like a T20 in 2024? Yeah, that's a perfect example of a lot of those players could bat higher in T20 cricket and sometimes do bat higher in T20 cricket. I don't think the South African model is a particularly good model, though, only because I think it works for them, but I don't think all teams should be trying it. Ben King says, Arco, 80 versus 90 versus 2000 versus 2010. Best team in the decade in a tournament. Which one wins? Me being biased, I feel 2010. My brother thinks 2000. Well, based on the fact that cricket gets better over time, it's probably 2010, isn't it? Just based on the fact that fielding gets better, running between the wicket gets better, fitness gets better, bowls are a little bit faster, spinners are a little bit faster and everything else. It should be 2010. But if you're looking at it based on like each individual era, you would, it's so hard to break down. But I suppose the 80s team has a huge advantage in that they have Botham, Imran and Kapil Dev and Hadley. But and I don't really count Hadley as an all-rounder in the same level as the other guys. But Hadley as well to pick from, which gives them incredible flexibility, which no other lineup has. 2000 and 90s get callous, but that's not as much flexibility as having the other guys I just mentioned. So if you're looking at flexibility and the best lineups to be able to put together, like having six bowling options and nine batting options, it's probably the 80s. And if you're looking at just the way that talent gets better, it's probably 2010s. Genius Genie says, who is India's second greatest batter of all time in all formats? One being Sachin. I've never been able to pinpoint it. And I don't want to penalise batters who didn't play ODI and T20. Well, you kind of have to. I mean, Gavaskar is obviously right up there. I would have thought Sehwag probably jumps someone like Dravid in that list, would be my other guess. Am I missing anyone else obvious? Oh, Virat, obviously. He's the other obvious one. So, yeah, I suppose Virat, it's either Virat, Sunil or Sehwag would be number two, I would have thought, in that list. It's interesting. We didn't really have, you know, in Sehwag's day, we didn't really rate the kind of ODI batter he was, but looking back, he was incredible. And obviously, in T20 cricket, even when he was well past his best, he was still absolutely fantastic in some of those years. We've talked about him having MVP years in the IPL, despite the fact no one noticed, because again, he didn't play the way that we technically looked at as great in those days. Virat's claim is very solid. Sunil Gavaskar actually goes on to be a better than average ODI player, despite the fact that he really wasn't suited to it. But he's such a better test player than the other two that he has to be in that conversation. Neil says, watching cricket at the ground versus on TV. Also, which English test venue do you rate most highly from a fan experience viewership perspective? Look, I can see more at the ground. So if I'm, and this is the wrong way of looking at it, Neil, because my experience is not your experience. But if I'm at the ground, I am in the press box and I also have access to the TV. So my dream situation in a press box is when I have two TVs and they're on two different delays. So we sometimes get one that's about 3 or 4 seconds delay. So you can watch the ball live and then swing your head up and then watch it live again. And then sometimes there's a normal TV feed, which is what, another 5-7 seconds later, that you can watch again. So I can watch the same ball three times in a row. There are things that I can learn at the ground that I can't learn on TV. And I can watch TV while watching the game at the ground. So it's always better to be at the ground from that point of view, right? But you learn a lot more watching on TV than you do at the ground as a spectator. Like, as a spectator, there are things that you can pick up, but without the access to be able to see wrist positions and footwork and replays and all those sorts of things, it's much better to watch on TV. Which English test venue do you rate most highly from a fan experience? Again, I haven't been a fan all that much in the UK, Neil, so I'm maybe not the best one to answer this. I think the grandstand at Trent Bridge, so opposite the members, that stand seems really, really cool to me. I love sitting in it as a as in any level. I've worked on about 3 or 4 different levels, and I've been in the outer there a couple of times. I've always liked that. I suppose the top of the OCS would be similar, and some of the new seats at Lord's look really good. But yeah, I'm not really a fan. Like, most of my experience in English grounds has been in the media, like 98% of it. Yash says, feel bullish about any IPL teams? I haven't even started to think about the IPL team. I think if you go back, we did a podcast which people didn't like because we tried to give our honest opinions and unstructured opinions on it. But we did a podcast where we went through, I think, you know, me, Varun, and Bayram, if you go through that, you'll probably see which teams I like more than I don't. But I'll worry about the IPL again as we ramp back up to the IPL. I love Mutton Biryani, says, is having the most biased TV commentator for the home side at present. I hadn't noticed him being all that biased. I hadn't noticed him being more biased than others. You know, in Australia, you know, I would have always said that I think Australia is probably, in general, the most biased cricket commentary. And also, if you're getting Fox, I think Fox is really biased as well. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know if I agree with it. But yeah, in general, I mean, one of the reasons I started writing about cricket was because of how much I was annoyed with Channel 9. They didn't respect the overseas teams enough. You didn't get enough information. They talked them down all the time. And I was just sick and tired of it. And, you know, not long after I started Cricket with Balls, Ian Healy said on air that Dale Steyn was the James Pattinson of the South African team. And I was just like, fuck off. That's so disrespectful, right? There's that great one too when James Brayshaw is commentating and he goes, I don't, if I was the Indian coach, and I don't know who the Indian coach is, but I'd be really, it's just like, and I think Lemon might have used that in his article about Channel 9. It's just like, what the fuck? Do some research. So I think Australians have been like that for a long time. It's quite an insular situation, you know, when it comes to cricket, I think at times over there. But yeah, I think there's heaps of biased commentators everywhere in the world. Anish says, when West Indies Australia dominated, were the other teams weak? So when West Indies dominated, you had Pakistan, who were really good and pushed West Indies, and you had New Zealand. So it was quite an interesting era because you didn't have what we now know of as the big three teams. None of them were particularly strong, right? But Pakistan were an incredible side. Very, you know, they had the great all-rounder. Decent spinners. Abdul Qadir was a great spinner in his era. But decent spinners as in decent spin options available to them even beyond Abdul Qadir. Their batting was a little bit light, and their batting actually gets better probably 90s and 2000s when the bowling isn't quite at the same level. But they were a really good side. New Zealand was an odd side because on paper it doesn't look great, but it worked, and Hadley was so dominant, and they got enough runs to back up Hadley that they were a really, really good side as well. So I wouldn't say that they were weak. Australia's era, you have the dying remnants of West Indies. You have South Africa. You have India at various times. You have Pakistan with some really strong teams in that period as well. And then you have England towards the end of that period. So I think I wouldn't say either of those were weak eras. Like that South African team from 95 through to 2007, it's a great team. Like it really is a fantastic team. They just couldn't beat Australia. It's a bit, you know, the interesting thing was, and I think someone might have asked this recently, of what would have happened if South Africa had played Pakistan. So South Africa of the 90s, 2000s, Pakistan of the 80s. I think that would be an interesting one. But yeah, I wouldn't say that those were weak eras, no. Anish says, can India ever dominate like Australia and West Indies in any format? Well, they just had a very similar record in Test cricket at home. So yes. I think it's probably harder to dominate now because the West Indies is kind of the beginning of professionalism. Though their players were professional because they played in overseas leagues. Then after that, you have the Australians actually getting to professionalism. I think it's harder to dominate at that level once professionalism comes in. But yeah, I think India could still go on a tear. Jack says, spinner bowling. Batter edges, the keeper takes the catch, but the ball pops out and hits the stumps and it's going down. Meanwhile, the keeper is able to get down and catch the ball before it touches the ground. Out. Again, I don't know why people ask me umpiring questions. Every time someone asks me one of these, all the umpiring Instagram accounts and TikTok accounts make a video based on me not knowing how to answer this question and then answer it better. I don't know is the answer. I would have to go and look at a law book in order to get that right. These are not questions that I can answer for you, Jack. I think the best thing to do is never to drop a catch in the first place. Aravind says, which test batter from the post-2010 era would have had a good record against Peak, Warne and Murali? Pujara? Post-2010? Michael Clark? Michael Clark must have played Murali, though. I don't know if he did have a good record against Murali. They're a little bit slower, those guys, so you can use your feet to them. And there aren't many players who use their feet well anymore. Both of those guys would be slow now. I don't know how slow Murali would be, but even he'd be slower than Ashwin, I would have thought. When we look at Hawkeye data, Warne is like in the top, in the bottom three. There you go. So Clark made 98 runs versus Murali and wasn't dismissed. Don't need you, Varun. I know these things. So I think there's an element of that, but it's such a different game. It's so hard. But facing them now would be a very different kind of challenge, because they would have to handle the fact that their bowling is a lot slower and batters are quicker on their feet. So if you did use your feet, you would be good. But no batters use their feet anymore because the spinners are so quick. So it's not an easy one to answer, Aravind. But Pujara is the one that instantly comes to mind for me. Hudson says, Harry Brook, Joshua Ayub, who is the biggest ceiling? Joshua. It's easy. A Singh says, have you been following Vijay Hazare Trophy? Does it make sense to pick Karan Nair for the Champions Trophy based on current form? I don't think they need to pick Karan Nair for that. I'm glad he's making runs again. I don't like it when players are just gotten rid of at his level of talent. But I don't think there's any reason for him to come into the Champions Trophy. They should know who their white ball team is. I wouldn't be worried about the Vijay Hazare stats, right? They should if they don't already know who their best team is, I'd be worried about them picking someone from Vijay Hazare. PT says, will Cricket Australia privatise a Big Bash team? So it was set up originally to be privatised. There have been various people at Cricket Australia who wanted it privatised. There have been various people at Cricket Australia who didn't want it privatised. I would assume one day it will be privatised. When that is the case, I don't know. Their big issue, which the ECB is about to go through, is you don't run it once it's privatised. And ECB and their 49% stakes that they're selling, the Ambanis don't care if it's 49%. They're the Ambani family. They're going to put as much pressure on as possible to get what they want, right? And not having a go at them either. If I bought 49% of something that at the moment is worth way less than what I'm paying for it, I'd be putting pressure on too. So for me, that I think what Cricket Australia will do now, and Cricket Australia traditionally has been a conservative organization. I think they'll watch what the ECB does. They'll watch what happens next. And then they'll make a decision off the back of that. Eventually, one way or another, it will privatize, but it may take a long time. All right, that is me done. Thank you for all the super chatters, all the normal chatters, all the Patreons, and everyone else. I'm Jared Kimber, and this is The Wagon Wheel, and we'll be back again next week for more of this kind of thing. Goodbye. Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.